Welcome to Drinks Insider, the podcast that's interested in everything you can drink. If it's legal, if you can sell it, and more importantly, if you can make money from it, then we're going to talk about it. So come on this journey into the commercial world of everything drinkable. I'm your host, Felicity Carter, and you're listening to Drinks Insider. Did you know that the alcohol industry talks to the UN? I had no idea. It turns out the alcohol industry has a representative body called the International Alliance for Responsible Drinking. As of 2024, its chief executive is Julian Braithwaite, who's had a distinguished career in the UK diplomatic service, including stints as ambassador to the UN in Geneva and head of the UK mission to the World Trade Organization. He's worked on everything from the Ebola response to antimicrobial resistance. IARD represents some of the biggest names in beer, wine and spirits, and these are the companies that are now under pressure from a growing public health movement that wants to lock them out of policy conversations altogether. I spoke to Julian about the shifting role of the WHO, the influence of temperance groups inside international health bodies, and what the industry needs to do if it wants to maintain public trust. Hi, Julian. Thanks for showing up today.
Hi, Felicity. Good morning, and thank you for having me on your show.
Okay, let's get straight into it. You have had a very long diplomatic career, including time as the UK ambassador to the UN in Geneva. Can you talk a bit about that, and then what drew you to a role in the alcohol industry?
So thanks, Felicity. Yes, I basically spent my whole career in the public sector, in the British Foreign Office, almost exclusively. And that involved starting off dealing with places like the former Yugoslavia. And then I started going to sensible places like Washington and then Brussels and then Geneva. And an important strand of my career has actually been working on economic issues, economic diplomacy. I did a lot of that when I was in Washington working with British companies operating in the United States, helping them work through the challenges of sometimes working in that great US market. And so that's where I first really developed an interest in that interface between public sector, the international economy, and business. In Geneva, well, in Brussels, I was the UK's ambassador, something called the Political and Security Committee, which oversaw...
The political what committee?
The Political and Security Committee.
Oh, I thought you said the Political Obscurity Committee, and I was like, what's that?
Well, that is actually a very good name for it, because I don't think anyone's ever heard of it. But it's made up of, you know, relatively senior representatives from all of the member states, and they oversee the EU's international policies, including its trade and international... trade policies, basically. So, again... quite a lot of interface with business there. And then in Geneva, I was the UK's permanent representative and ambassador to the UN in Geneva and the World Trade Organization. So lots of interface with business there, actually particularly in the context of the World Health Organization, which provides the normative framework that affects a range of different industries. So again, engagement there. And I mean, we'll come on to it now, really, which is I personally and the UK government generally has always believed in the importance of engaging with the private sector, of harnessing their resources and their innovation to achieving public goals within suitable frameworks that are not set by business, but set by governments, of course. But that we've always been of the view that actually, yes, of course, they have commercial objectives, but they also have resources, innovation. They deal with problems, issues, consumers that are important for addressing these public goals, and therefore harnessing them to achieving those outcomes is an important way of getting things done. And when I was thinking of leaving government, and I'd often been interested in doing things outside of government, working in the private sector, this was the sort of thing I wanted to work on, at the interface between, you know, multilateral systems, government, and the private sector. I didn't have any particular sector in mind, but I wanted really to work in a sector that does have, you know, does have an impact on major issues of public policy and public goods.
Can I just go back a step? I'm really interested in the work that you did with the WHO. Am I correct that you worked there during the Ebola crisis and that you worked on antimicrobial resistance? If so, tell me about working with the WHO.
So I went out to Geneva in 2015, and the Ebola epidemic in West Africa was still in full swing. This was the big thing that was going on that Geneva was doing in the world. It was dealing with Ebola. And so I went out to West Africa to see the UN in action, including the WHO in action. In Geneva, two major things really that I was involved in with the WHO. One was antimicrobial resistance, which was a British government priority, which is tackling the fact that antibiotics are becoming increasingly, microbes, diseases are becoming increasingly resistant to antibiotics, and we need to do something about it. It's a major challenge. And that was a British coalition of countries led that, working with WHO. And the other one was learning the lessons from Ebola to prepare for the pandemic that we all knew was going to come at some point, because that's the nature of the modern world.
I'd love to ask you both about the former Yugoslavia and about Ebola, but let's get to why you're here, which is IARD. What is IARD?
So IARD, it's a small organisation with a very important membership. It's a membership organisation. It's made up of the leading beer, wine, and spirits companies around the world. So it's got major companies, household names from Europe like Heineken, Carlsberg, Moët Hennessy, Pernod Ricard. Also the leading companies based in North America, but also operating in markets around the world like AB InBev, Bacardi, Molson Coors, Brown-Forman, and also some very important Japanese members as well, like Suntory Global Spirits, Asahi Kirin. So these, collectively, these companies represent, their household names, they're very, seriously led and organized international businesses. And they represent in many ways a critical mass within this industry. And IARD is their collective membership organization for addressing, the big externality in their industry, which is the alcohol and health agenda. These are responsible companies that sell excellent products to people who are drunk in moderation or enjoyed all over the world. But of course, alcohol, when consumed harmfully, has harmful consequences. And the companies want to be absolutely at the forefront of doing what they can do as private sector organizations to show that they absolutely support an agenda to tackle the harmful consumption of alcohol. And that's what IARD exists to do.
If I were to be cynical, I would say that a group called the International Association of Responsible Drinking is a front for big alcohol to do cosmetic things to stave off legislation and regulation. What would you say to that?
Well, we're an alliance, not an association. That's the first thing I would say. But the important point is that...
Alliance of Responsible Drinking. Yes, sorry.
And that's the important thing. We're not a front organisation. The name is on the tin. We're an alliance of companies and indeed partner organisations committed as private sector organisations to addressing this big public goal, which is tackling the harmful use of alcohol. The front organization is the sort of the language of sort of temperance and prohibition, really, because it's about the underlying assumption of the critics who say that is that any private sector engagement in this area is somehow suspect and dubious, rather than the view that I've always held within government, which is that, yes, the private sector has commercial objectives, but it also has responsibilities, and responsible companies harnessed within the right frameworks have a very important role to play. And that is what IARD does. And the fact is, the United Nations recognises IARD. We have something called ECOSOC status, which means we are organisation.
You've got what? Say
so
that again.
So the UN has a system for recognising organisations, non-governmental organisations, whether private sector organisations or civil society organisations, which is called ECOSOC status. And IARD has ECOSOC status, which means, far from being some shadowy front organisation, first of all, we're a membership organisation, and I'm very proud of the members that I serve. And secondly, we're recognised by the United Nations. And that's one of the reasons why we get invited and are able to attend UN multi-stakeholder events, because the UN, and we'll get onto that in a moment, has one of its fundamental principles is the importance of partnership with the private sector. That's known as SDG 17, or Sustainable Development Goal 17, is all about partnership. And we're recognised through those processes. So We're not a shadowy organisation. We're a UN-recognised organisation.
Well, one of the things that, you know, I spend my time doing shamefully is reading a lot of public health information. And one of the things that they say over and over is that private enterprise is about selling products and should not have a role in public health. They're not expert and there's an inherent conflict of interest. So, first of all, can you respond to that? And then secondly, perhaps if you could detail some of the ways that IR deals with the externalities of alcohol.
So yes, of course, my members are commercial organisations and they want to sell their products. But there is no conflict of interest in wanting to sell products to be consumed moderately and sensibly, and not wanting to sell products that then are consumed harmfully with negative consequences both for consumers and for wider society. I mean, that, you know, you know, that can never be a conflict of interest of a serious company that wants to, you know, have a long and successful commercial future ahead of it. You know, you don't want to be selling products in ways that then get abused and misused and lead to serious consequences, negative consequences. Of course not. So the idea that that's a conflict of interest and that somehow these companies just want to sell alcohol, however it's consumed by however, whoever, is, you know, is to completely misunderstand what, you know, commercial objectives look like. You know, it is, you know, these companies' commercial objectives not to sell alcohol in ways that can be misused, because that is not a sustainable business model.
So give me just one, maybe just give me an example of the way members work to, you know, promote responsible drinking.
So, you know, we have, basically there's three key areas. The first is, you know, the commitment of our companies, and through IARD we have an explicit role in this, which is to prevent underage drinking. So prevent drinking by people under legal purchase age. And IARD does this in all sorts of different ways. We support legal purchase age in all of our markets. Indeed, we've worked with governments around the world to introduce legal purchase age where that hasn't been the case. We've also carried out through, you know, our collective marketing and advertising a sort of transformation really of the way in which digitally alcohol is advertised and sold online, which has obviously been a huge area of development in recent years with the expansion of e-commerce. And through partnerships with online platforms like Meta and Google, we've worked to introduce age gating. We've worked to introduce opt-outs from alcohol marketing on Meta platforms, for example. Those things wouldn't have happened without the combination of IARD partnerships with those organizations and the advertising and marketing spend of my companies, which have driven change across the online sectors in this area over recent years. We were asked by the United Nations, again, talking about the role that IARD can play. We were asked as an industry in 2018 by the United Nations to take concrete steps to eliminate the marketing and sale of alcohol to minors. And it, particularly in the digital space, we've really made pretty significant strides in this. It's one of the things we're presenting back to the UN this year, which I can come on to in a moment. So that's one area.
We'll come on to that in a second. But
finally, I just wanted to cover the two other areas, because the other one is promoting responsible consumption. So promoting consumption in moderation within, you know, the drinking guidelines as defined in our major markets. You know, that's very different, very important that we are, when we're marketing our products, that we're doing it in a way that is promoting moderate consumption. And that's baked into the way in which those products are marketed and advertised. And then the third area is working in partnership, often, with governments around the world to tackle harmful consumption, so drink driving, for example. So, you know, my companies are involved in both supporting those sorts of programs around the world and also doing very imaginative and effective marketing campaigns, responsible marketing campaigns, particularly around those sorts of things, reaching their consumers in a way that no other form of information campaign could, because, you know, they know their consumers and can reach them better than anybody.
Okay, now you've also got a science section. Why and what do you use it for?
So look, science of alcohol and health is incredibly important, and it's really important to understand it. And so we have a science section that provides a sort of analytical function for our members so that they can understand what are the developments in the science of alcohol and health, because they want to make sure they're, you know, they understand those and they're not on the wrong side. The last thing, you know, the last thing we you know, we as IARD or our member companies do is ever promote alcohol for its so-called alleged health benefits. And we're very explicit about that. You can read it on our website. But it's also, and it's very important also that, you know, we're not in the business of second-guessing public health authorities about alcohol and health. But it's important that the companies understand this, because this is the major externality for this industry, which is that, you know, the harmful consumption of alcohol can, guess what, lead to alcohol harms. And we need to understand how those manifest, and we need to understand the science. So it's basically an analytical function. We do not conduct scientific research. IARD does not conduct or commission scientific research.
Let's go back to the WHO. So there's lots of WHOs. Can you explain what's the difference between WHO Global, WHO Europe, and maybe PAHO, and how does it all sit within the broader UN system? And how do these different groups relate to alcohol?
So the World Health Organization was set up immediately after the Second World War. It's a classic mid-20th century intergovernmental organization, massive affair based in Geneva, very independent of the sort of UN secretariat in New York. It's got its own governance made up of member states called the World Health Assembly and the Executive Board. However, it's not the oldest, you know, World Health Organization or regional health organization, because PAHO, the one in the Americas, existed before the World Health Organization and got sort of folded into it in a sort of very confederal way. And there are regional World Health Organizations all over the world. There's one in Europe, for example, based in Copenhagen. There's one in Africa. There's Asia Pacific, and so on and so forth. So there's about half a dozen of them. PAHO is the one that covers the Americas. Now, they are pretty independent of WHO Global in Geneva. They have their own governance made up of their own regional member states, and they sort of operate within a global framework. But, you know, they're pretty independent. They're not sort of branch offices of WHO Geneva, for example. So it's sometimes quite confusing for people, because they'll hear that WHO brackets Europe has said something, and it sounds like that's the WHO talking, right? But actually, it's the team in Copenhagen talking. Now, they all have their own teams dealing with what's known as non-communicable diseases, which are the global killer, you know, things like diabetes, heart disease, cancer. And they are all focused on the sort of risk factors that lead to those conditions, of which alcohol is one. And they produce statements on that. And so you occasionally hear things that sound like it's WHO Geneva talking, but actually it's another part of the WHO operating actually pretty much independently, or very much, yes, very semi-independently of WHO in Geneva.
Yeah, now my understanding is that a lot of people have asked me about how the withdrawal of US funding and funding from Argentina is going to affect this issue, but this issue is coming out of WHO Europe, and that's funded separately, is that right?
Correct. Yeah. So the US is obviously a member of the WHO, the World Health Organization in Geneva, and certainly when I was in Geneva, it was the largest donor, the World Health Organization, contributing about 20% of its budget. Most of that, something called voluntary contributions as opposed to the mandatory assessed contributions. Now, the US is pulling out all of its voluntary contributions and its assessed contributions in 1 year. It's transformatory for the WHO in Geneva. I mean, I've never worked for a bureaucracy that's had to go through a 20% budget cut in 1 year. I don't know how you'd manage it. So WHO Geneva is going through massive change. I mean, you know, the other member states of the WHO have agreed to step up their assessed contributions, so they're finding ways to plug the gap. But this is what's interesting about WHO, and it's an important thing about understanding the World Health Organization, indeed all of these WHO organizations, is they are strictly intergovernmental organizations. You know, they operate under mandates given to them by their member states, by countries. However, they do get their funding not just from member states, but also from philanthropic donors. So the first largest donor to WHO back in the day when I was in Geneva was the United States. The third largest was us, the United Kingdom. The second largest was the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation.
Right.
Which is an extraordinary state of affairs when the second largest donor to an intergovernmental organization can actually be a philanthropic organization. Of course, you know, that raises all sorts of questions about how the conditions behind the provision of that money are consistent with a governance structure that is intergovernmental and an organization that is very much, and according to its constitution, an intergovernmental organization.
Yeah, I mean, one thing is, you know, trying to find out who funds the WHO, it's actually quite opaque sometimes. I've tried very hard to go down the rabbit hole and look at who funds what. It's not that easy. But it looks like when you look at the alcohol issue specifically, I've been going back through WHO documents back to the 90s, and it does seem they've gone from being sort of descriptive about alcohol to being prescriptive, that they're actually now launching advocacy campaigns. Is that something that is typical for an intergovernmental body?
So, I mean, this is where the non-governmental funding comes in, because I think some of these advocacy campaigns are funded through non-governmental funding rather than through governmental funding. And because the WHO has always had an ability to take this voluntary funding, including from non-governmental organizations, you know, that's one of the big changes, I think, that's happened in particular over the last 20 years. So that means that things can be funded that weren't mandated directly by the member states. So that's possibly part of the explanation for this. However, strictly speaking, the WHO still operates as ever under mandates given to it by its member states intergovernmentally. And those mandates in this space are very clear. There's the UN strategy to reduce the harmful use of alcohol, which was agreed in 2010 through the World Health Assembly, which is like the committee of all of the member states who are members of the WHO. It's basically every country in the world. And they agreed this in 2010. And that basically is the underpinnings of all international alcohol policy and since then, which is based on these two core principles. One is a focus on tackling the harmful use of alcohol, and therefore a distinction between harmful consumption and moderate consumption. So not all alcohol consumption is the subject of public policy. Harmful consumption is the thing that they are trying to reduce, not consumption per se. Very important distinction. That's the first. The second is this concept of the whole of society approach, which is a fancy UN phrase for saying we achieve our outcomes and we achieve success by brigading together the resources of government, civil society, and the private sector to deliver our progress on tackling the harmful use of alcohol. That was established in 2010, and it's the basis of all of the multilateral WHO and UN frameworks ever since, including the NCD monitoring framework that was introduced in 2013, including the series of political declarations on the prevention and control of non-communicable diseases that were passed by the UN General Assembly in New York from 2011 through to later this year, 2025, and it's baked into the Global Alcohol Action Plan, which has agreed to implement the UN strategy back in 2022.
I can feel listeners going, oh, that's a lot of things going on. Okay, so basically, yeah. If I could just sum up, there is a WHO, but it's actually multiple organisations, some of which are funded or some of which get their funding from private partnerships. The fact that the WHO has lost its US funding doesn't necessarily mean that the Copenhagen office, which is what deals with alcohol, is going to be any less active because they're funded differently. And the current view of the UN is to reduce harmful alcohol. All right, so this is a really big topic because there's
just one correction. That, yep. You know, WHO Geneva also deals with alcohol policy, has its own alcohol policy unit, of course. So you have these different groups in all of these different organisations have their different teams.
So how does it manage with two alcohol teams? Do they clash? Because I know, you know, I know the Copenhagen team, I know their names, but, you know, how does the Geneva team fit into all of this?
So, you know, they definitely cooperate. They do joint events. You know, officials from from both of those teams will get together. You'll see them doing presentations, attending panels, etc. But and also you'll have WHO Geneva officials attending the launches of WHO Euro publications, for example. Most of the publications in this space have indeed come out of WHO Euro. I'm trying to remember who were the officials who wrote the famous article for The Lancet in January 2023.
Karina Ferreira-Borges was the lead author of that.
So, and I think
she's
that there
in
were
the
others.
Copenhagen office.
And there were others. But they, you know, the headline was WHO famously says there's no safe level of alcohol consumption. When you look at the article, you know, The Lancet is a very serious publication, it's very clear that the authors are speaking in a personal capacity. You know, only perhaps former bureaucrats and diplomats like me would say that's an important distinction, but it is an important distinction because, of course, the formal WHO position is the one defined through their mandates, and that says, you know, we're tackling the harmful use of alcohol. Thank you very much. We're not tackling all use of alcohol. But what some of these WHO officials, including by writing articles in a personal capacity in very distinguished journals like The Lancet, are saying is, no. There's no distinction between harmful consumption and moderate consumption. All consumption is unsafe.
Yeah, it's no safe. Well, actually, so just to clarify, that Lancet article came out. And then very shortly afterwards, the WHO put out a statement saying there was no safe level of alcohol, which is actually extraordinary because, as you say, the spotlight had been on, you know, harmful consumption of alcohol. So what's the implications of this? Are you suggesting that this is sort of people inside the organisation going rogue, or is this a formal WHO position?
Well, it's interesting. I mean, it's if you look at their websites, including WHO Geneva's, it does talk about, you know, no safe level. It uses various formulations. That's basically what it says, which of course is weirdly in contradiction with the official mandates and policies that the WHO is pursuing through the UN strategy, the Global Alcohol Action Plan, etc., which is focused on tackling the harmful use of alcohol. So, why this might be, and it's a very big organization. Like any civil service, you know, you're under the sort of political control. Whitehall, officials wouldn't be able to go around advocating for changes to policies that have been agreed by ministers. And the parallel in the international system in an intergovernmental organization, you would think, is that officials are working, you know, civil servants working with those organizations shouldn't be going around advocating for changes to the policies agreed by their member states.
I'm going to go with the going rogue hypothesis, which is mine. It's not Julian's. That's my tabloid approach. One of the interesting things about reading the public health material again and reading the anti-alcohol is that they say this emphasis on responsible drinking and harmful drinking was inserted by industry, and that in actual fact, you shouldn't talk about responsible drinking or harmful drinking, that all alcohol drinking is harmful. Is that just propaganda from the anti-alcohol people, or is that true?
So, you know, this is things I like about my current role is that the evidence is sort of, does not stack up for these changes that the advocates are pursuing. So, and this is where the science of alcohol and health comes in. And as I say, IAR doesn't have its own views on what the science of alcohol and health says, but we do follow the debate on this, and we follow in particular the reviews of what the science on alcohol and health says. And the most serious, comprehensive and methodologically sound and transparent, very importantly, in terms of its methodology, review of the science of alcohol and health that's been carried out recently is the one that was carried out by the National Academies of Science, Engineering and Medicine in the United States. They were commissioned by the US Congress as part of something called the US Dietary Guidelines regulatory process to review all of the science in a sort of serious and methodologically sound and transparent manner. And they appointed a panel of very distinguished scientists with specialities in this field to review it all. And they reviewed it all, and their findings are well worth reading, because what the findings basically say is that there is, for people who drink moderately, and that's defined in the United States within current US drinking guidelines, for people who drink moderately There is a 16% reduction in what's called all-cause mortality, which is, you know, the risk of dying from all the potential causes, compared to people who don't drink at all. Now, that, as I say, IARD would never go around saying that alcohol has health benefits, but what they are saying is that there isn't some direct linear link between alcohol consumption and harm. You know, what we do is we survey the reviews of the science, and then we look at the ones that are basically methodologically most sound. And the NASM one, the National Academies one, is the most sound and the most recent one, and that's what it says. And you know, we sensibly don't come up with our own opinions of what it says. We quote them directly, and I've just done so. But I think there's an even more important point here, which is this: we're talking about risk. We're talking about the public understanding of risk, and you know, that's what, you know, drinking guidelines in the United States or the United Kingdom do. They provide a way for the public to understand the risk of drinking alcohol. You know, the you know, US authorities and the UK authorities are not saying that, you know, alcohol has no risk to it. They're just saying that within these boundaries, the risks are not so serious, or you know, are small, not to say very small. I'm not going to say they're net positive, but you know, what they're saying is the risks are very small. That there are risks of different diseases linked to cancer, and they go up from one very, very, very small amount to another very, very small amount if you stay within these drinking guidelines. And that is really what's important here, is to help adults to make informed choice about managing risk in their lives. And that's what these drinking guidelines do. The whole No Safe Level campaign or movement, if I call it that, it deliberately obfuscates that what we're talking about is risk and the public understanding of risk. They say that every drop of alcohol increases your risk of certain forms of cancer. And that sounds terrifying to people. And they say, well, I'm definitely not going to drink any more alcohol in that case. What they don't say is, you know, every drop of alcohol through the, you know, to the drinking guidelines in countries like the UK increases those risks by a very, very small amount to another very, very small amount. And therefore, what public health authorities need to do is help the public understand risk so they can take informed decisions about managing risk in their lives. And the No Safe Level logic completely kicks against that.
Yeah, the other thing that really struck me about one of the documents I was reading is they made a point of saying, you know, there's no alcohol that's better than another. And of course, that's not true. If you're drinking a, you know, hard seltzer that's 4% alcohol in one sitting, of course, it's a different risk profile to drinking, you know, shots of vodka. But let's talk about the UN. So there's a really important meeting happening this year, the UN high-level meeting on NCDs or non-communicable diseases in September. Can you explain what's it all about and where does the alcohol industry intersect with this?
So why do these obscure meetings taking place in sort of, you know, the United Nations actually matter?
Where is the meeting going to be held?
Well, it's going to be in New York.
Oh,
it's
nice.
Going to be on in the UN headquarters building on the east bank in East Manhattan. So that's where it's going to be. It's going to be in September. Now the reason it matters is because there are these periodically every, you know, 4 or 5. In this case, 7 years, there's what's known as a high-level meeting on the prevention and control of non-communicable diseases. And that's a big meeting during that big ministerial week in New York when prime ministers and presidents all fly into New York for meetings of the UN. And there's going to be one this year. The last one was in 2018. And the reason this is important is because as part of that process, they agree a resolution that all of the member states of the world of the United Nations agree by consensus are on non-communicable diseases. It's called a political declaration. So there's going to be a political declaration on the prevention and control of non-communicable diseases. Now, this is not legally binding, but it's incredibly influential. And it does cover the private sector because of the fact that a number of industries, whether it's, you know, food or soft drinks or indeed beverage alcohol, have consequences if consumed harmfully that have consequences for non-communicable diseases. So there. And also, because of this thing called the whole of society approach I mentioned, you know, the private sector is included in helping to solve the problem, helping to address the problem. So this is the reason this is so important is this is a moment where those who think that the current policy, which is based on those two foundations I told you about, tackling the harmful use of alcohol through a whole of society approach, those people who think that's wrong, and actually we should shift policy to tackling all consumption of alcohol, not just harmful consumption, and we should keep the private sector out of there because of these conflicts of interest that mean they're such bad players they can't even be included in helping to solve the problem, those people would like this moment to be a moment where the member states change the mandate. You know, we've been talking earlier about advocacy groups pushing for this, and including some officials in WHO civil service pushing for this. But it only becomes a new mandate for the WHO if an intergovernmental resolution, either in the World Health Assembly in Geneva or the UN General Assembly in New York, agrees it. So that's why it's so important. We just to be clear, you know, well, we'll come on to whether or not, because we've talked about whether the science has changed to justify the shift from.
Well, actually, has the science changed to justify this?
Well, this comes back to the NASEM report. Basically, what the NASEM report says is that the sort of consensus, which is that actually the correlation between consumption and alcohol harm taken collectively is not linear, and that within drinking guidelines as defined by, say, the UK government or the US government, you know, the public can reasonably consume within that, safe in the knowledge that that is moderate and responsible levels of consumption. The science that underpins that approach, if you look at the NASEM report, has not changed in a way that would justify departing from that public policy approach.
Yeah. All right. Let's talk about some of the advocacy groups that you've touched on. Who are these advocacy groups? And does it? Just tell me who the advocacy groups are.
So, I mean, look, I'm not going to get into going into the details of different advocacy groups.
In a sense, what are they trying to achieve? Where do they come from, and what are they trying to achieve?
So, I mean, some of them. And, you know, look, there's lots of very respectable people involved in this. And, you know, when you're focused on a single issue, see the world through that single issue. So I'm not impugning the motivations of people involved. But the motivations of some of them and some of these organizations have, you know, stem back many, many years. And they've gone through various sort of rebranding. But a number of the organizations who are very active in this space have very long and distinguished histories as temperance organizations.
Yeah, I think I should be clear about what we're talking about. So we're talking about groups like Movendi, who used to be the International Order of Good Templars, who are actually, they were a temperance group. They've rebadged themselves as a civil society public health lobby. They're actually a partner of the WHO. So they're one of a number of NGOs that are hard at work on this issue. What role do NGOs and advocacy groups play at the WHO?
Well, this is one of the interesting things. And when I was an ambassador to the WHO, I wasn't so aware of this, but the WHO has a category of non-governmental organizations that it has official relations with, which is you have to apply to have an official relationship with WHO. You have to go through a vetting process, and ultimately that has to be signed off, not with any debate, I don't believe, by the executive board of the WHO, which is a group of member states that represent the WHO's membership. And Movendi International is an organization that has official relations with the WHO. So it is an organization, as I say, as you've just described, with a very distinguished temperance history, and therefore, with a very single-minded focus on alcohol, obviously, and the importance of reducing alcohol consumption, because that's just a good thing in and of itself. I don't think they would describe officially that's their reason for doing it, but that's their background. And it is a bit odd that an organization with that sort of, advocacy history as a temperance organization should be able now to attend all these WHO policy meetings as they do, and very actively engage and go around saying, you know, we've got to get rid of the harmful use mandate because all alcohol consumption is, you know, is harmful and there's no safe level. And they pop up at every WHO meeting and they go to the ball and say precisely that. You know, are they, you know, health NGOs? They're not really.
And then they write social media posts saying that big alcohol is corrupting the discussion, from what I remember. And I think that's you.
So, you know, as I mentioned the point that IARD is recognised by the UN, has ECOSOC status, and also that the UN recognises the role that the private sector can play in these processes through the whole of society approach, which means we are able to attend these multi-stakeholder meetings and indeed speak there. And that's indeed what we do. That is not illegitimate. It's not somehow secretive. We're not there under any false pretenses. We're there because actually the UN recognises us and recognises the role that the private sector can play in this area. So, you know, if you happen to be a temperance organization or one that has a distinguished temperance history, which Mavendi does, you may think that is wrong, but that sort of reflects, you know, that you're a temperance organization.
So how much influence do these groups really have? Are they just another voice among many, many voices, or do they have some influence?
Well, as I say, they have official relations inside the WHO, which IARD doesn't. Actually, most private sector organisations don't, to be honest. So WHO has its own system of recognising non-governmental players, which is this official relations one. It happens to recognise an organisation with a distinguished temperance history, so very much with a particular agenda that it is advocating, but has less private sector representation. But the UN as a whole has broader inclusion, broader representation. As I say, the actual the UN policies and the UN strategy do talk about the importance of the whole society approach. And indeed, the industry and IARD participate in a dialogue with the WHO. We're part of the Global Alcohol Action Plan, which is the main plan for implementing this strategy, which is agreed through the World Health Assembly. So, you know, we are included in engagement with the WHO and in the delivery of WHO action plans.
Do you think it's a good thing that these groups are involved? Do they bring a much needed perspective? Do you think?
Look, I'm just a humble representative of the private sector, and the WHO is an intergovernmental organization. You know, with my previous hat on as an ambassador for a UN and WHO member state, I might have a view on that, but I'm going to reserve as a humble representative of the private sector. Yeah.
Okay, let me ask a different question. Do you think that WHO member states are even aware that there are temperance groups in official relationships with the WHO? And if they did know that, do you think they would care?
Well, I wasn't aware when I was the UK's ambassador to WHO, and I'm not sure if I fully understood the official relations system, to be honest with you. When you have organisations with agendas that are not, you know, very transparently recognised in international policymaking environments, that is an issue. You know, you want to know what are the influences playing out in these policy debates. And you want to know, you know, are they representative and who are they representing? And in a strictly intergovernmental organisation, like the World Health Organization, you know, that the role of non-governmental organizations is an important issue that the member states who are formally, you know, responsible for the governance of WHO understandably will have a view on. As I say, it's not something that's necessarily very well known, because as I say, I didn't know about it. That doesn't mean that, you know, other ambassadors didn't know about it, but I'm not sure how well, I don't think it was well known at all.
No, it's absolutely wild. When I first learned about it, I didn't believe it. I kept going back and rechecking and checking. I was like, what? Temperance groups working on alcohol policy? But now, you know, they seem to be getting louder, which could just be because I'm paying more attention, so it seems that way. But I noticed there's a growing talk of a framework convention on alcohol control, which of course famously happened in 2003, 2005 with tobacco, which mandates things like people from the tobacco industry may not speak to government, that they're locked out of the process altogether. Do you think there is any chance of a framework convention on alcohol, or is that unlikely?
So, I mean, that's, you know, you raise a very important point, which is that there's a, there is a, there is a model out there controlling, you know, the private sector when it comes to a major public health issue. And that's the Framework Convention on Tobacco Control, which, as you say, came about in the early 2000s and is a WHO treaty. It's internationally legally binding treaty which basically incorporates all of the key aspects of tobacco control that were developed actually in different jurisdictions beforehand in the United States and elsewhere, but they're banning advertising, banning marketing, putting up prices through taxation, plain packaging, graphic warning labels, exclusion of the industry from any engagement in public policy consultation or delivery. You know, that is the model. And, you know, it's not, you know, perhaps it's not surprising, but it's also quite revealing that some of the people who are now involved in talking up this idea of an alcohol control treaty have a distinguished background in tobacco control.
Yes,
you do have a bit of a linkage
yes,
there.
Unemployed tobacco control advocates.
But yes. I think the important point, and this is what's so important, is you need, I have a strong belief in evidence-based policymaking. I mean, at its best, that's what the British government has done. At their best, that is what these great international institutions do. And what does the evidence say? And we've talked about, you know, has the science changed to justify moving away from a focus on harmful consumption to a focus on all consumption? And I've talked about the NASEM review, the comprehensive review, that doesn't actually provide a justification for such a shift. That's the first point. So that's piece of evidence number one. Piece of evidence number two is the data on whether or not the UN strategy to tackle the harmful use of alcohol is working or not. And there are a number of official UN indicators to track that progress. And two of the key ones is, one is called alcohol attributable mortality, which is an awful phrase, but basically it means to what extent has alcohol contributed to, you know, alcohol-related deaths around the world. And the WHO officially collects the data for that official UN indicator. And they published data last year that said that alcohol attributable mortality had fallen since the onset of the UN strategy in 2010, had fallen by 20% globally between 2010 and 2019. An extraordinary public health development, very little known, but that is what the WHO's own data says. So, you know, that's, I think, piece of evidence number two that suggests, according to official UN indicators as collected by the WHO, that there is real progress in this UN strategy.
Yeah, I mean,
second point I just want to, which is the other big indicator, is alcohol per capita. Now, you can debate whether or not, particularly this point that alcohol per capita and harmful consumption are actually two different things, and harmful consumption can go down without average consumption necessarily going down. But, you know, put that to one side, it is one of the official indicators, and it's the only indicator when it comes to the alcohol part of the Sustainable Development Goals, which is another of these great UN frameworks. That, you know, the WHO just published data just last month, saying, and their word was, this is remarkable, saying that the world is on track to achieving a 20% reduction in alcohol per capita consumption from 2010 to 2030. So if you're measuring a strategy by the metrics and indicators that were established to measure that strategy, this strategy is making progress. So where is the evidence, the justification for changing it? Surely the answer is reinforce it. Understand better what's working around the world and reinforce those policies.
Yeah, I mean, it seems extraordinary to me that we're hearing so much about the dangers of alcohol at a moment in history when alcohol is dropping precipitously, and it's dropping everywhere. It's really interesting. Just a final question. One thing that is true, and I think, you know, as a journalist writing about wine, we're always thinking about, you know, what can I write about new markets? And there's been a lot of attention paid by journalists like myself itself on potential new markets in Africa and Central Asia. But then I read the public health material, and one of the things they say is that the alcohol industry is going to go into sort of alcohol naive countries, bust them open. They have very young populations and probably cause a plague of alcohol harms in the near future. And part of me thinks, well, actually, maybe that's true. What is IR doing to make sure that doesn't come to pass?
So, our standards, all of our companies who are members of IR have signed up to those standards around responsible marketing, around prevention of underage drinking, and around working with governments to actually tackle harmful consumption. And, in parts of the developing world, there aren't even legal purchase agents. So there isn't even a legal definition of underage drinking and indeed an ability to make that illegal. And there are examples where IARD and its members have worked with the government in such countries to introduce a legal purchase agent. So that's an example of the sort of behaviour that our companies do pursue in the developing world.
Give me an example of where you've done that.
So Cambodia is an example of that, for example. I mean, in, one of, these, my members are household names. I mean, everyone's heard of Heineken and Carlsberg and Pernod Ricard, Bacardi. They have global operating systems, global principles, global standards. And the best, in a way, they, the way in which they are going to operate in developing world markets is going to be consistent with those standards. So take one of the biggest challenges in parts of the developing world, which is illicit alcohol. I'm not saying that all alcohol production or all alcohol companies behave responsibly, but my members in many of these developing markets are responsible players who are looking to deal with and actually working with government on tackling illicit production of alcohol, which can often mean that the alcohol that's produced has methanol in it, which can kill people. And there are governments around the developing world who do work with my member companies in order to try and tackle illicit alcohol. There's often a confusion between sort of cultural practices, which involve sort of versions of home brewing, which have been long established as parts of cultural traditions. But that is definitely not the same as what's going on in quite a lot of developing markets, where there's industrial production of illicit alcohol in very unsafe conditions, marketed very unsafely, not regulated because, it's illegal. And that's where our companies can play a role in partnership with governments that want to tackle this and have done so in a number of countries around the world.
Yeah, I was actually in Africa last year, and one of the big companies told me their warehouse had been knocked off, obviously by organised crime, and all of the bottles must have been, they must have done something with the alcohol, but they refilled the bottles with dangerous illicit alcohol. And when there were problems as a result, the company got blamed.
So this, this does happen, and there are, as I say, there's examples of good collaborations where actually our companies who have no interest in their branding being, illegally used in this way, as you could imagine.
Yeah. Okay. So final question. I mean, we are hearing a lot more about No Safe Level. There's a lot more in the media. There's not very much information about the fact that alcohol harms are actually dropping. Do you think the industry is under a real threat of losing its social license to operate, or is this current public health policy push just another wave that will wash through?
So, look, I think it's very important that that the industry and through IARD, its members are absolutely showing that they are responsible players in an industry that does require the private sector to act responsibly and to act within regulatory and normative frameworks. So we've got to keep on doing that. You maintain that social license to operate sort of every day by doing that. Is there a global trend that means that in a way we're heading towards a new era of prohibition where actually in effect the industry loses its, social and legal license to operate. I mean, I think that's, that is, you can't be complacent. And as I say, there are you know, some groups who would like to go down that road and are quite active, as we've been discussing. But, you know, the proof of the pudding will be in what, you know, ultimately countries and member states in the United Nations do, which is why things like this meeting this year is so important. Let's see what this new political declaration says about alcohol and health. Will it shift away from a focus on harmful use and a whole of society approach or not? I think there is a difference between where the member states are, the countries that are actually responsible for the regulation of the industry, and where some of the advocacy groups are. Now, you know, there are other trends around wellness, et cetera, which is sort of rather different. It's less to do with social license to operate and just to do with consumer trends. And, you know, there's fierce debates about whether those are, you know, are those cyclical or structural? And, you know, analysts debate this sort of thing endlessly. But that's a rather different thing from losing a social license to operate. I mean, all I would say is, you know, I proudly work for an industry that's been around for, you know, what, 8,000 years or more. You know, it's had its, you know, it's, you know, and I'm pretty confident it's going to be around, you know, in 8,000 years' time. So that's probably what I'd say in terms of providing a long-term perspective on the issue.
And on that note, thank you very much, Julian Braithwaite.
Leslie, it's been a pleasure. Thank you very much for having me on your show.
You've been listening to Drinks Insider, the podcast that explores the intersection of beverages and commerce. Now, if you would like a summary of this episode, sign up for the Drinks Insider newsletter, which sends you the takeaways. Just go to drinksinsider.com and add your name. And if there's something you think we should be talking about, drop me a line at felicity@drinksinsider.com. And before you go, please don't forget to rate this podcast. 5 stars are most welcome.